Hi, how's it going?
Hey, it's wonderful. It's very sunny here today. How is it there for you?
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, Warsaw. I'm just outside of Warsaw and it's wonderful. It's sunny. It was quite cloudy, but you can feel late summer in all of the swings. It's very nice.
I love it. Well, welcome. We have with us here today Łukasz, and this podcast is part of the Access 2020 event that we've been having for the past month in August. This program falls underneath the Usable project with Internews, and Łukasz had hosted one of our community-led sessions, our Skillshare sessions, and we're happy to be able to share about his project today and some of the things that he's passionate about when it comes to digital security. So welcome, Łukasz.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. It's such a pleasure and such an honor. Thank you.
Yes. Łukasz, could you tell us a little bit about who you are and what your background is and what you're currently thinking on and working on?
Sure, of course. So hi, everybody. I'm Łukasz. I'm usually based at somewhere in Central Europe. So now sort of I'm usually traveling between Warsaw and Sarajevo, which both of the cities are absolutely wonderful. I'm currently in Warsaw and I'm really, really missing the hills of Sarajevo though. And by education, by trade, if you could call it such, I'm a political scientist. And this sort of allowed me to pivot a bit more into thinking about security from a psychological and from a social perspective. And I've been doing and attending digital security trainings for quite a while already. And one of the things that I kind of noticed was that whenever we were talking about specific tools, very often the lesson was, we're doing this tool because the trainer told us to use this tool. And when I sort of started asking people around, why are you using this tool? Why are you using Signal here? Why are you using WhatsApp? Why are you using Telegram? I think that the most common reaction I got was, because someone I trusted told me to use this tool. And while I think that that's fantastic that people can rely on trusted sources and people can rely on trusted friends, the issue is that such knowledge is not particularly future-proof. So a VPN provider, which might be great in January, might no longer be a good option in August. A messaging app such as TextSecure, which was seen as the recommendation, no longer exists and has, for example, been rebranded to Signal. And we don't know in which way, let's say, messaging apps such as Signal, WhatsApp, VPN services, and a lot of other things will develop. So I noticed that a lot of digital security trainings focus on giving people really fantastic knowledge, but giving this knowledge in the moment, giving them the current state frozen as it is. And I noticed that a lot of trainings weren't really focusing on figuring out in a couple of years from now if we should use this product, service, or tool, and if this product, service, or tool fits into our respective threat models. So I've sort of been doing a lot of work over how can we create something like a checklist? How can we create a simple list of rules to allow people to figure out if a current product is like legitimate, good, or fits into their specific use case and threat model?
Wonderful. Thank you. So thank you, Łukasz. And for formalities, I will be hosting our podcast today. My name is Carrie Winfrey. I'm the founder and lead at OK Thanks. We are an interaction design firm and have done much work on open source tools that are privacy centric. So I'm super excited to be able to speak with you today, Łukasz, and just explore kind of how some of the things we've been thinking about intersect. And you had mentioned having this very simple checklist that equips people to assess tools to understand how secure they are. I think this is super important to empower people in this way. And also noting that these things do change from moment to moment. So it's important to be able to decide for yourself and really determine for yourself if something is safe to use, and if you can trust the people that are behind it. So I would love to dive in and hear more about what the simple checklist is, what is it about, and how would someone use it? So I think, Wukash, if you would, take us into the scenario of how you would talk someone through assessing a tool.
Of course, with pleasure. So, I mean, first of all, I think that the first thing, and that's a really, really good friend of mine helped me figure this out when I was discussing the checklist with him initially. He said that most of the people we are training are already doing some sort of fascinating and deep research already. So most of the people we are training will be, for example, activists who have been poring through tax records, or sort of journalists who have, for example, been analyzing and investigating huge swathes of data. And if we, for example, ask those people a question such as, is this financial institution legitimate, or is this a local government report accurate, they would instantly have an answer. But at the same time, there's something interesting happening, whereas whenever we started to talk about digital security or digital tools in general, I think a lot of people would feel that this was not particularly for them. And I mean, for me, it's sort of been, technology has been sold to us as magic for a very, very long time. And technology has been sold to us as like the type of magic that we cannot touch, feel, open, or interrogate. And at the same time, I think that the types of people whom we are working with, a lot of them already have these tools to sort of look into and interrogate almost any structure that they find in their lives. So one of the reasons why I did this in the form of a checklist was to sort of empower people and reassure them that they can make easy decisions about digital security, just like they can make easy decisions about lots of other factors in their lives. For example, whether to trust a certain institution, whether, let's say, a bank or financial institution they investigated is legitimate, anything really.
Wonderful. Yes. And I love that notion of really empowering people and so that they can be reassured and make an easy decision. Digital security can sometimes feel very complex and complicated, and it is complex. So to have a way to make simple decisions really makes it accessible for everyday people who may not feel super tech savvy, or who may tend to just shut down when it comes to being tasked with understanding if something is secure or not. So yes, there's such value in this. I know in some of our work and research that we have done over the past year, we were trying to understand how people decide how to trust apps, how they decide which app to download. And we were diving in, we did multiple interviews in various parts of the world. And we wanted to understand the behaviors around it, around getting apps, deciding which one they would choose. And this was all done on an understanding that there are fake apps or clones of apps that exist out there in the world and in the marketplace. And in some cases, this was actually having a bad effect for some tool teams that were working to develop open source tools. So that was the kind of base of the research project. But to tie back into what we're talking about now, we did hear a lot that if someone you trust tells you to use it, that's very quickly and easily permission to use it, you know?
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think that that's a very, very good reason to use it as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yeah. And we also found, however, though, the person that was saying, oh yeah, you can trust this, you can use it, or that was sending you a link to download an app, they may not actually know. Like, they could have been handed a fake version of an app or one that has malware in it. So yes, it's good to to be aware of both of these things. And I think to really emphasize the importance of the product and the work that you have done, empowering people and equipping them with their own way to like check and see is really important and critical in what we're doing. Would you like to walk us through, say, if, I mean, video conferencing has been such a huge topic in the midst of COVID and so many folks having to shift from and shift what they're doing even more online or online completely if they weren't doing their work that way before. So with video conferencing, there have been some things that have happened with Zoom and news that has come out. Would you like to walk us through how you would assess Zoom today and if it's something that you would feel has all of the kind of security features that you would need in the context that you're working in?
Yes, of course. Very quickly, though, you touched upon something really, really interesting also about a trusted friend who might be recommending an app. And the trusted friend might still be giving you a fake version of the app. And I think that it's actually really important to like distinguish social trust from technical trust. So I think that technical trust is sort of the trust for the other person to do something very, very well or be very well skilled in something, where social trust is trust on a very, very personal level. So for example, let's say that I would have very, very high social trust towards my best friends, which means that I would probably, you know, trust them with my life. I would definitely trust them, you know, with the keys to my flat, with cat sitting, with anything. But there's no way I would trust them to, for example, reliably remove my appendix. And I would like definitely, of course, if it's on the implant, whereas I would definitely reliably trust a doctor to remove my appendix, whereas I wouldn't probably, you know, give the doctor who removed my appendix and my house key and be like, hey, I'm off for 2 weeks. Can you please take care of my cat? So I think that sort of it's very, very important to realize that trust actually goes into many dimensions, and like social trust and technical trust are two quite different things.
That's a very good point. It seems in the medical world that line may be a little harder drawn than when it comes to recommending products or apps for people to use as well. You know what I mean? So there's...
Yeah, no, of course.
Yeah, that line gets blurry depending on what it is before you. But I love that. Yes. Yeah, there are.
I mean, yes. And I mean, I'm always afraid of like downloading a fake version of an app. So what I will usually do is I will at least both like open if the app has a Wikipedia page, I will probably open a Wikipedia page. I will then open a Google search for the app in case someone modified the Wikipedia page. And then maybe I will also check if an institution like the EFF or someone else linked to the app. And only if two or three of the URLs are actually the same, will I really, really trust the app. So like I'm super, super fearful of fake apps as well.
I love that process that you go through. It's very good. We have another mini checklist for what to do before you download an app.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love checklists because the world is so complicated and life can get so absolutely overwhelming for me. For me, a checklist just means you sort of outsource your a lot of your thinking and a lot of your memorization to a piece of digital paper. And that's always so, so helpful for me because it means that you are not responsible. You don't have to stress about missing any of the elements.
Yes, I would liken that in my personal life to meal planning. if you have everything written down that you're having, you don't have to come home and ask the dinner question, what are we having for dinner tonight? We didn't thaw any meat out. Oh no, we're eating out. but yeah, reducing that mental capacity that people have that it requires to take. Reducing mental capacity is huge. And I love that also that checklists do that for you.
Yes, exactly. And I think that like one of the main items on the checklist for me is just to really check, you know, what do people you trust say about this product or app? Or the other thing is sort of, does this product or app make any misleading claims? So are there any controversies surrounding it, right? And I think that Zoom is an absolutely fascinating example of this, because with most services, what happens is that they build our trust, and then they do something that makes us lose our trust. So there was the Wire messaging app, and I still use them quite a bit, but I think that they took, for example, new investors on board from new jurisdictions, and they took quite a long time to tell the users about the new investors. And I think that a lot of people were very upset that there was such a lack of transparency from a company that marketed itself as a security-friendly one. That's Wire. But with Zoom, actually, it was kind of the opposite. So Zoom started off by growing very, very aggressively and actually doing a lot of security missteps. So they would, for example, call themselves encrypted, whereas they weren't really what most people would understand as encrypted, because they were only encrypting the communication from your computer to the Zoom servers rather than the communication that was passed around, if I remember correctly. So essentially, Zoom was pretty much mis-selling. And for me, like, mis-selling was a huge, huge red flag. And then sort of they changed.
And how did they change?
So one of the big things they did is they really withdrew and they really backed away from a lot of the security criticisms that they received after a while. So they totally changed the course. They first of all got really, really, they announced a feature freeze for quite a certain amount of time, which meant no adding of new features, just focusing on security. And I think that this was the first signal of reliability. They became very, very transparent about the security features like waiting rooms and stuff that they would integrate. And finally, I think one of the really important things that they did was they got a bunch of pretty reputable security professionals on board to serve sort of as consultants. And one of them was, for example, Alex Stamos, he actually quit Facebook after disagreeing with the Facebook board's position on Russian disinformation. Essentially, Alex Stamos is one of those people for whom I think reputation is very, very important, and who definitely not want to destroy his reputation by being involved with a company that doesn't treat security seriously. So essentially, the fact that they hired someone for whom reputation was very important and they managed to keep this person on probably meant that they are very, very serious about security and that people who are starting to work with them are very, very serious about that as well.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, that's a great observation. Are there, I know within the checklist that you've developed, there are, you spoke a little bit to, yeah, what do people say about the product? And your second point is, have the product claims ever been challenged in court? What are your observations related to Zoom on the second point?
So I'm afraid I haven't been tracking Zoom sort of. So with a messaging app, it's a bit different because the main claims that would be challenged in courts would be either claims for user logs or alternatively things, for example, when VPNs are being asked for logs. And there haven't really been any super high profile court cases with regards to Zoom yet. There have been cases where Zoom has bowed to some not particularly democratic governments, and it's been rightly criticized a lot for this. But in general, there haven't been any like big demonstration court cases. One of the reasons why I put it why I put the court case thing there is because I was fascinated in Signal's response about this. So what happened once was that Signal was essentially taken to. There was a law enforcement request for data on a Signal user, and Signal only managed to give two pieces of data on this person. So the last time they logged in and the moment at which the account was registered, Signal was not able to provide any other data. They were not able to provide any data on whom the user communicated with. They were not able to provide any data about the content of the messages. They were not able to provide any data about, I don't know, the locations from which they were connecting or whatever. And this is a law enforcement request, right? So essentially, if Signal did not agree to provide this data, or if they had lied about the type of data they had available, they would probably be facing very, very serious legal consequences, probably including prison time, depending on the jurisdiction. So essentially, if Signal says that they don't have this data, they cannot collect this data, and they do so essentially literally putting their own freedom or future of an organization as a guarantee, that's a pretty, pretty big green flag. And if, for example, and a lot of other VPN, a lot of other apps, for example, VPNs have done this as well, right? So for example, there are VPNs which have had court cases against them, and they've literally been unable to give in user data because they haven't collected them. So for me, actually watching what happens when there's a threat of legal action against the institution is one of the best ways of checking whether or not or what data they log and how honest they are about the data they do log. Because of course, there have been some VPNs which have promised not to log, and the moment the police asks for them, suddenly the logs appear. So another interesting thing for me are all of the congressional hearings about in the US and in other countries as well of tech leaders. And essentially, sometimes Congress will ask leaders, for example, if the company is able to access such and such communication or whether or not it's encrypted or not. And in some of those cases, the leaders will be talking under oath, or they will be facing criminal penalties for saying the wrong thing. So essentially, if, for example, a CEO of an organization can testify under oath or a similar measure, or face criminal penalties for lying to Congress or another government body, and they still say, we cannot access this, this is fully encrypted, then I think that that's a very, very good reason to trust them. Alternatively, they might be cooperating with the government on some sort of secret tribunal, but that's pretty unlikely. So I'd say that's a huge green flag and we can probably trust them.
So your third item on the checklist is what data or permissions does the product require from you? It seems that there are some you spoke about in court cases. It's often highly realized what a company like Signal actually knows about you when they're asked to give over data. Can you share with us about this kind of third point about what data or permission does the product require and how you would actually go through and assess or know the truth about what they're, the data that they're requiring from you?
Sure, of course. So I think that if there are products that have been designed from the ground up as privacy products, for example, very secure messengers, such as Signal, or for example, VPNs, if they collect any more data than the basic sort of minimum, that's instantly seen as slightly suspicious. So Zoom actually wasn't created as a security first product. Zoom was probably created as a like uptime, convenience and quality first product. And this means that sort of Zoom can usually collect a bit more data than most of the other ones. But for example, Signal collects next to no more data than your phone number, right? You don't, for example, need to sign up with both a phone number and an email. If you did have to sign up with an email, that would be slightly sketchy. Like, why are they trying to collect more data about you than they really need? I've also been really interested in VPNs and how little data they can collect. So Mulvat, the Swedish-based VPN, for example, doesn't even identify you by email address. They can just identify you by a 16-digit code. And in all of those cases, if someone collects that little data, it means that they are very, very well designed. It means that they are essentially, they've taken a long, long time to think about the design to make sure that it's as private as possible. And if in the worst case scenario, such a company would get breached or have, for example, a law enforcement request, it means that there would be very, very little data that they could collect about you in the first place or that they could reveal about you in the first place. So I think that if you, for example, put your sensitive communications in a company that in no way ties into your real life identity, this means that even if the company were, for example, breached and let's say some metadata were leaked, they would not be able to tie it back to you. But this is also why, for example, the requirement for services like Signal or WhatsApp to require your real phone number can be so controversial, because in a lot of jurisdictions, you cannot really get an anonymous phone number easily. You do, for example, have to register your phone number with your ID card or your passport. So essentially, theoretically, law enforcement authorities know who's behind every phone number, which means that if you're in a less than democratic jurisdiction, it means that sort of corrupt police officers could easily figure out which real life identity stands behind which person in a Signal group, for example. So even stuff like phone numbers, could be very controversial to collect, though I know that the Signal team has just, or at least tried to justify it very, very well, that they need the phone numbers because that's the easiest way in which people can find each other, et cetera, et cetera. And they are working on a way beyond this. But for me, for example, if Signal would no longer require any phone numbers and move to usernames, as they are planning to do soon, that would also be a huge, huge green flag.
Could you help me understand? I'm thinking about an end user or an individual that may identify themselves as non-tech savvy and kind of new to digital identity and what that actually means. What advice would you give to someone who is kind of looking at tools and saying, okay, I need to think about the personal information they're collecting on me. What advice would you give to them to help navigate how you know, if an email is okay or if a phone number is okay versus other methods? I think, thinking at a very raw level, there are standards that are set, right? So in a lot of messaging apps require your phone number. It seems that for some people, it's like, well, it's so normal that you don't even really think about it. But you talked about the implication of in many places, like your phone number is connected to, like it's registered with your ID in your country, you know, so it's highly tied to who you are and what other information your government may know about you because of that. But yeah, at a very raw level, what advice would you give to someone who's new to this kind of thinking to understand what is okay to give away in regards to their personal identity?
I mean, that's an excellent question. And I would say that in most cases, I would probably need to ask the person themselves for the very, very simple reason that, you know, we as digital security trainers cannot know what's happening in every situation or in every jurisdiction. And sometimes a large part of our job is just listening to people, right? So if we were, for example, asking journalists or activists from a not particularly democratic state, they would probably know much, much better what sort of data can easily be traced back and what cannot. And then I think sort of they will usually know much better, for example, if the government ever relies on phone IDs or not. They would know much, much better about those sorts of things. So it kind of reminds me of the old joke that in countries that were once occupied by Soviet authoritarianism, you would sometimes start a phone call by saying, first of all, hello, let's say, hello, Carrie. Oh, and also hello to the colonel who's listening into a phone call. I hope the colonel is having a good day as well. So I think that in a lot of those, places, sort of, you know, knowledge of surveillance has been very, very pervasive. And very often people will know much, much better on the ground. So I don't want to sort of, you know, step into places where people whom I'm training have much, much better on the ground knowledge than I do. But yeah, in general, I would say that sort of be wary sometimes of your phone number, unless you can easily get anonymous SIM cards. I would probably show people how to use an easily disposable email address. And I would probably also show people that sometimes it's reasonably easy to register services that don't track you, or that actually have a business model that don't track you. Because sometimes if I would talk about services like DuckDuckGo, and I think that this can also extend to like services that give, for example, disposable email addresses. In a lot of those cases, people just found it difficult to believe, really, that those services don't track you because they were so used to tracking and data collection as a pervasive internet data model. So I think that sort of giving people the confidence to see that actually some businesses or some organizations are built in a model that doesn't include tracking, and just even hinting at this and telling them, you know, trust me, this is the case, can go a very, very long way.
Yes, that's a wonderful point. I want to we're moving to the point 4 on the checklist, which is related to location. So where is a product and its developers based? Would you so kindly tell us about why this matters and what the considerations are?
Yeah, of course. So I think that jurisdiction is one of those things that can be kind of important. And I think that its importance cannot be over-exaggerated either. So in many cases, you probably want your product to be in a reasonably legally stable jurisdiction. Or for example, if your threat model comes from the types of people who are based in the country that your product is done in, you probably shouldn't do this, right? You probably shouldn't be using the product. So if, for example, let's say your threat model is Russian secret services, you probably shouldn't be using products that are based in Russia, just because Russian secret services could, for example, have some sort of way of, let's say, for example, threatening to arrest the founders of the product or coercing them into giving up data on you. You are much, much better off in using products based in jurisdictions that are much further outside of your threat model. So I think that this is really, really important as a starting thought. And I would say in most cases, you should probably look at products that come from jurisdictions that you would consider to be reasonably democratically and politically stable. So I think that in a lot of those cases, there's always a risk that a police force or someone could come and knock on the doors of the product developers and ask them to, for example, build in a backdoor. And the stronger the democratic system in the country, the more sort of oversight there is over police forces and over intelligence services, the less likely it is to happen. So once again, this is a very, very local decision. And I think that I would definitely want to ask activists on the ground and journalists on the ground about it as well. Do you, if, for example, they are thinking of using a mail service that's based in the country, one of the first questions that I would ask them is, do you trust your country's, for example, security services not to coerce your mail hosts for, let's say, your communication details or metadata?
Yes, I wanted to highlight as well, you brought up a couple of times how important it is to ask the people within that within their local context, because they are often very knowledgeable about these things and what about the jurisdiction itself. I wanted to highlight that we have within our Axis convenings over the past month, we have seen this. We have seen this firsthand in being able to connect with so many folks across the world who are working very hard and diligently within their communities. We have seen that knowledge, and it is there. And there are people, I would say, even if you live in a particular context and you don't feel that you know all the things that you need to about your jurisdiction, there are certainly people within your community that do have that knowledge. All right. Everything that you have shared has been super insightful with the checklist.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes, of course. There are many more considerations included, which I would love to go over all of them. But there's one specifically that I want to make sure we highlight before we wrap up our podcast for today, and that is open source. Could you tell us about why this is on the list and why it's so important?
So, I mean, first of all, I'm sure that this podcast, given the fact that it's a very open source context, will definitely be very, very biased towards open source. And I'm super biased towards open source in almost all of my security tools as well. So essentially, if it's open source, it means that the code is freely available for anyone, and anyone can, you know, really read it, study it, or remix it. Now, in theory, this means that everybody can look through the code and read it in the spare time. In practice, unfortunately, it means that it's mostly restricted to people who know coding and computer science really, really well. And unfortunately, we've also had some pretty nasty bugs, errors, and backdoors in open source software. So just because the software is up online and everyone can read it doesn't necessarily mean that it's like free of bugs, but it means that people can generally take a look at it and vouch for its accuracy and vouch that it says what it does. And this is really, really important, especially if someone's launching a new product or a more niche product. So one of my favorite examples about this is Objective-C. Objective-C, Objective-SEE, is a suite of security products for macOS. And it's done by Patrick Wardle, who's considered one of the foremost experts in macro security. But honestly, very often when I see a security product, I'm slightly skeptical, because if there's one way I could gather the data of all the types of people who are paranoid, require encryption, and have elevated security needs, it would be by essentially publishing a security product and letting it contain a backdoor that, rather than protecting your data, actually takes all of your data. So essentially, for me, security conscious people can actually be much, much more vulnerable because they get a lot of sensitive data and deal with a lot of sensitive data. So Patrick Wardle did put up almost all of the source code or all of the source code for Objective-C tools up online, which essentially means that any security expert or even most advanced coders can just look at the code and see that it does what it claims to do, that it doesn't exfiltrate any data from your computer, that it doesn't contain any nasty backdoors, but that it does what it has to, what it has to do and what it's been designed and what's been labeled to do. And this in itself is a huge, huge green flag. Now, I think that we sometimes overstate the capabilities of open source software. Just because something is open source does not necessarily mean that it's 100% secure and that anyone can instantly find security bugs in it. Some security bugs are very, very nasty and very difficult to find and very difficult to read. But in general, it's at least a good guarantee that the software doesn't take any of your data, that it doesn't contain any particularly nasty malware, that it doesn't try to steal or exfiltrate anything. In short, it's usually a guarantee, but it does what it claims to do and it does what it says on the box. Now, there's something even more complicated with open source software, which is called reproducible builds. And I don't want to get into that in huge depth, but essentially there's always the question of how do we actually know that the app that we download, let's say on a phone, on a computer, is the same version of the app which has the source code put up on, let's say, a website like GitHub. And this can be sometimes difficult to determine. There are sometimes very clever cryptographic ways of doing it. And Telegram, the messenger, has been pushing, if I remember correctly, quite heavily into reproducible builds and sort of doing this. So usually with non-open source software, you kind of have to trust the company about the contents of the software and you have to trust its claims. So with WhatsApp, which I'm still a fan of in spite of everything, you have to trust Facebook that WhatsApp does what Facebook claims it does. Whereas with a lot of the other software, like with Telegram and with Signal, you can look at much of the source code and verify for yourself. And that's really, really powerful, especially for like startup apps, more niche apps, and especially for products targeted towards security professionals. Because part of me is always fearful that products targeted towards security professionals have potential to just be a honeypot that collects everyone who has sensitive data and gathers and exfiltrates this data.
Yes. I want to ask a similar question that I had before about this. If I am non-tech savvy and I'm looking at an app's website or product's website, and at the end it's like, we're open source. I'm like, that is awesome and great. From that statement, how assured can I be that the kind of due diligence has been done, that someone that knows what they're doing, a security expert or someone that more tech savvy than myself, has gone in and checked the code and made sure that there isn't terrible malware and that the code is truly honest?
That's a fantastic question. So, I mean, I think that one of the things that we could definitely do in our trainings is to, for example, show people, let's say, the contents of GitHub. I mentioned GitHub beforehand. It's a place where people, or GitLab as well, both of those are places where people send through their contributions to open source software. And both of those are places where people can sort of see how many people have contributed to it. How big is the group designing it? Is it a single person? Do they receive a lot of feedback? That's the first thing. Other bigger projects, for example, Linux, have very, very well-documented commits, but they aren't particularly sort of, the code for Linux, let's say, isn't particularly beginner-friendly. And I think that the last thing is that the bigger or more prominent or more popular the open source app, the higher the chance that more and more people have looked at it, right? So if, for example, I were to create Wukash's super encrypted messenger tomorrow, and I was the only contributor and all of the code appeared on GitHub overnight, that's kind of sketchy. But if we're, for example, looking at something like, for example, Signal, there are lots and lots of security professionals doing audits of Signal. There are lots and lots of security professionals writing about Signal. And in most of those cases, they've expressed very, very positive opinions. So like this in itself is something that's, you know, really, really important and useful as well. I think that like open source allows universities, professionals, companies to start performing really deep and fascinating audits and analysis of it. Sometimes the results are great. Sometimes, for example, Telegram's crypto has been critiqued quite a bit. But the very fact that like Telegram's crypto has been very openly documented, that all of the source code for the crypto is available, this in itself has been like a huge, huge green flag as well.
Thank you for unpacking that a bit more for us. Wukash, it has been a pleasure to have time with you. I love your eagerness and excitement to dive into all kinds of topics, actually. But it's been lovely to have this time today. And for those that are interested, Wukash does have this the information and the checklist published on his website. So it is accessible and available to use. And as I understand, if anyone is interested in collaborating on it or giving input, Wukash, you're very open to that.
Yes, I would love to. So, I mean, I really love sort of crowdsourced digital security projects. And I'm always trying to find more projects and like bigger lists and especially checklists too, because I think that there are a lot of really cool guides. I'm slightly obsessed with checklists just because I think that organizations very often have very, very few easy and straightforward checklist processes that they can use. So I'm always keen to create more.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you so much for having me.